Good morning, Silver City and Grant County. You're listening to Earth Matters on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM. I'm Donna Stevens, the director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and I'm your host for today's show. Today, I am interviewing Nathan Newcomer, who is the Gila grassroots organizer for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and we have several topics that we're going to cover today. Good morning, Nathan.
Good morning, Donna.
I know that recently you've taken two very different kinds of trips. So let's start with the one where you were out in the Gila Wilderness on a backpacking trip. And I know that the purpose of this trip was to commemorate the 90th anniversary of the designation of the Gila Wilderness Area. So what can you tell us about your trip?
So this was a trip that began a couple of months ago where it was just going to be me doing some kind of a fun backpacking trip by myself. But then it started to materialize that since I was doing this, and the timing was as such that, like you said, I was going to be coming out on June 3rd, which was the 90th anniversary of the Gila Wilderness being designated, that it made a lot more sense to kind of make it a work situation and to publicize it that way. So I talked with my executive director, Mark Allison, and he agreed to join me, although he checked with me first to say, are you sure you want me to come on this trip with you? Are you sure you want to make this a work trip? And I said, yeah, I think so. And it was kind of a twofold thing where we wanted to celebrate and commemorate the 90th anniversary of the Gila Wilderness and celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, but also to commemorate all the people that have loved the Gila Wilderness, that have worked on the Gila Wilderness, or have worked and loved wilderness in general. And so we asked our membership to send us names of people that have passed on, that loved the Gila, that cherished the Gila. And we got a really great response. We got about 250 names that were submitted to us. Some people wrote letters that we read aloud along the Gila River as we did our backpacking trip. We actually did it on the fourth night, halfway into the trip. We read all 250 names and letters and notes of sentiment of people that had cared and loved the Gila. So that was a really humbling experience to be in the middle of nowhere and to be in America's first wilderness, reading all these names and reading these stories of people that are no longer with us in human form, but their spirits certainly still are, to read those names and to read the impact that the Gila had on people's lives was really profound. And it really kind of struck home when we were doing the backpacking trip how important it was to keep protecting places like the Gila and to keep the Gila wild and free. So, yeah, we went out in the end of May and came out on June 3rd. It was 7 days in the wilderness. It was probably one of the most spectacular trips I've ever done in my entire life. It was 50 miles that we did. The only other 50-mile backpacking trip I've ever done was in the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness in central Idaho. That was beautiful. But I have to say, this one in particular, going down the Gila River was beyond magical. Photographs don't do it justice. Words don't even do it justice, to be honest with you. When you're walking down the Gila River, you know, you're passing places like Murdoch's Hole. You pass by peaks that don't even have names. It's just, you know, this is just the Gila Wilderness. It's just the Gila. But you feel like you're honestly walking through one of the greatest national parks in the entire world. But it's not a national park. You know, there's no billboards, there's no, like, gas stations or anything like that that you find in national parks. But it kind of had that feel of being in a really just, wow, you know, where am I? Every corner that you turned around was like, wow, you really couldn't believe where you were. And the fact that you didn't see anybody else was also pretty magical, too.
What part of the river did you walk? Where did you start?
We put in at the Forks, which is just above Grapevine, the confluence of the West Fork, Middle Fork, just above the East Fork where it comes in.
Yeah.
Then we walked all the way down to Mogollon Box.
Oh, wow.
Now, that is not 50 miles. That stretches more like 40, 42. But we did a couple little day hikes throughout the trip to kind of reach the milestone of 50, to commemorate the 50th anniversary. So, yeah.
But the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act.
Correct.
Oh, okay.
So that'll be in September of this year. September 3rd, 1964 was when the Wilderness Act was passed. And so we had the 90th that occurred in June 3rd of this year, and then the 50th of the Wilderness Act in September.
Yeah,
and
two big anniversaries.
Two big anniversaries, and we're really fortunate that the National Wilderness Conference is going to be in Albuquerque in October this year to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act.
Right. So why is the wilderness important? Why is the Wilderness Act important, and what's so important about the Gila Wilderness?
Well, you've been in the Gila Wilderness, Donna, haven't you?
Yes, I have. I know why it's important to me, but why do you think it's important in general?
Sure. I think that a lot of times people don't necessarily understand what wilderness is. They think, when they look at the national forest, they think, well, isn't it just all national forest? And it's like, yeah, it is. But there is something called wilderness. And wilderness is this concept where human beings are allowed to visit wilderness areas. You can experience primitive forms of recreation like hunting, horseback riding, canoeing, rafting, hiking, backpacking, so on and so forth. But you don't remain. You get the opportunity to encounter, as Phil Connors said in an interview that I did with him, that was a great word, I think, that really encapsulates wilderness. Encounters. You get to encounter something that really we don't get to see much anymore. You know, the ability to go and run into a black bear or see a mountain lion if you're really that lucky, which I did see my third mountain lion on this last backpacking trip, which was fantastic.
Yeah.
Most people don't get those experiences, but in wilderness areas, you get that experience. You get the chance to encounter something that human beings used to encounter on a daily basis, essentially. But now that we've developed almost the entire globe, there's very few pockets of places, of wild places that are left untrammeled by man, like the Wilderness Act says, untouched, unspoiled, that are free to do their thing, that are free to continue as they have for millennia. So the concept of wilderness, why is it important? Well, it began right here in Silver City. It began here in New Mexico. And now it's a gold standard worldwide. We've seen wilderness bills passed in different countries now. And now it's used as the gold standard for protecting wild places into perpetuity so that they can be there for our children and their children and for future generations to come. I think that's a concept that when people experience it and they get to know it and they get to love it, it becomes a part of them. It's certainly a part of me and something that it's my job. And that's why I'm so passionate about it, because I really feel strongly that wilderness keeps us connected to something that, you know, you can't get from your laptop or from your iPhone, your iPad, or from your Facebook or your Twitter account. You know, wilderness is so much more beyond that. It's really primal. And it's sort of like, it's like my church in a way. You know, when I go to wilderness, I feel really connected with things bigger than me, because it makes you feel so small. You realize, you know, you just saw a mountain lion, like, holy cow, I just saw a mountain lion. Like, I'm really one of the smallest people in the world right now. And there's so much things bigger than me that it keeps you humble and it keeps you grounded. At least that's my perspective. And it's something that I think we should continue to fight for and continue to work to protect more places as wilderness. And the Gila is just kind of, you know, the fact that it's America's first. When you go through there and you walk through there, you're like, wow, okay, now I really get it. And now it really, really makes sense and just brings it all home.
Well, you were saying a little while ago about how you brought these 250 names of people who feel really connected to the Gila and who really loved it. And I was out on a hike last weekend. I wasn't in the wilderness. I was in the Gila National Forest. And I was stopped at the side of a stream in the Black Range. And there was a little metal plaque nailed to a tree. And it was this tribute to these two people who had really loved that particular place. And it was just so sweet to see that, you know, that this was a really special place to these two people who have died several years ago. And it was, I mean, I didn't know either one of them, but I just felt really connected to these two people who I don't even know because they love that spot.
Yeah, it's the power. It's the power of wild places.
Power of wild places. It was a very beautiful place that I was in. So I wanted to ask you, what was the favorite part of your trip? If there was a favorite.
You know, that's a really tough question. You know, I probably would have said the mountain lion sighting, but since it was my third, I kind of have already gone through the euphoria of seeing a mountain lion, you know, once or twice.
Yeah.
It was really great to see that, but there really isn't one particular moment, just because, you know, you spend a week in a wilderness area. By day three for me, that's when I'm fully, like, I'm there.
Yeah,
I've checked out completely from civilization and work and emails and whatever, phone calls. So like by day three, my mind is completely set on wilderness mode, if you will.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a spot that was just north of Murdoch's Hole. Murdoch's Hole is a pretty popular, or was, I should say, a pretty popular swimming hole. Now it's full of sediment and debris, like rocks and trees. So it's no longer the big swimming hole that it used to be. Sorry for our listeners who are have fond memories of Murdoch's Hole. It's not the same anymore. But just north of Murdoch's Hole was this utterly stunning rock edifice, just this monolithic thing where the Gila River suddenly bent and turned south. And you could see over the course of, you know, centuries and millennia, the river carving through the Gila mountains and the Durkee Mountains up there, that this area where it was going west and then it had to suddenly curve south had carved out this dramatic, just towering pinnacles, these huge mountains. And you're standing there looking at that going, my God, like, wow. It just captivates you utterly and completely. But there was multiple times where that happened. So that was probably the first of the trip where I was just completely engrossed with my surroundings and starstruck, if you will, by my surroundings. But yeah, it's really hard to say. I mean, Sapio Creek, you get down to Sapio Creek and you see all these cool looking, you know, caves and, you know, areas where people probably lived. So many other areas that were on that trip that were just as spectacular, just as gorgeous. Maybe the coolest thing that I saw, other than the mountain lion and all the scenery, was when Mark and his dog were about, I don't know, maybe a couple miles in front of me, because I was doing field work with my tablet. Here I am talking about being engrossed in wilderness. I actually did have a tablet with me because I was documenting wild and scenic river characteristics. So I was doing work. But they were in front of me, and you know, you have to realize that since the flood from last summer, most of the trail system out there has been washed away, and so you're having to pick and choose the, you know, path of least resistance, basically.
Yeah.
And I was following essentially bear tracks. The bears had found a little path through all this debris, and so I was like, okay, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for me. And I'm following these bear prints, and then the bear prints eventually lead to a segment of the trail that's still there. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, great, here's the trail. And then I see Mark's boot print, his dog's boot, or his dog's paw print, and then on top of Mark's boot print was a mountain lion print. And it was going the same way that they were going. And so that was actually about half an hour or 25 minutes before I actually saw the mountain lion. So seeing that was pretty intense, to look on the ground in real time, see my partner, my colleague's boot print with a fresh mountain lion track right on top of his track, going the same way. I've never seen that before. So that was kind of really neat.
Did it make you a little bit nervous?
Oh, no. No, I was really excited, actually, when I saw that.
You didn't start singing or anything to make noise?
No, actually, I don't.
That's what I usually do.
I don't do that. I mean, I know you're supposed to do that. I only do things like that if I know that I'm following an animal. Like if there's bear scat, for example, and it's fresh. And if I start to get into a really narrow canyon, per se, where there's a lot of vegetation, where it's really thick, like you're hiking through willows or you can't see very far in front of you, then I'll start to sing my favorite Frank Sinatra song or whatever and whistle. You know. But other than that, I tend to try and be really quiet, because when you're quiet, that's when you get to see things.
Right.
So I try not to make noise. I try to be really cautious on what I step on, so I'm not cracking sticks or kicking rocks, things like that. Because I know that when you stay quiet, and if the wind is blowing in the right direction and your scent's not going downstream and you're going downstream, then the chances of seeing wildlife are greatly increased. And that's the best part, you know, when you get to encounter a mountain lion or a large black bear or just deer or elk or turkey. I mean, anything. Yeah. I mean, it's just so cool when you get to go, hey, check that out.
All right.
It's really neat.
All right. Well, we'll be right back after a break. We'll find out more about Nathan's trip, besides just the fact that he's a closet Frank Sinatra fan. Mm-hmm. We're back with Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM. I'm Donna Stevens, your host for today's show. And joining me today in the beautiful downtown Silver City studio is Nathan Newcomer from the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. Before the break, Nathan was telling us about a trip he took recently to commemorate the 90th anniversary of the designation of the Gila Wilderness Area. So, Nathan, I wanted to ask you if anything unexpected happened on your trip.
Yeah, actually, the first day, or second day, and we saw somebody. We weren't expecting to see any people. We saw a guy that was doing the Continental Divide Trail, actually. But he told us that, real briefly, he was not in a mood to have a long, thorough conversation. He was on the move. But just in passing, he said that hiking up the Gila River was kind of being designated an alternate route for the Continental Divide instead of going over the Black Range to the Alto Leopold Wilderness because of water, basically. So we saw him, and then about, only an hour later, if that, we saw three more people on horses. They were, it had just been Memorial Day weekend, so I think that's why we saw some people. But other than those four people on the second day, we didn't see a single person until we got down to Turkey Creek and then to Mogollon Box. There were obviously some folks down there too. The one thing that was a little disturbing, I have to say, is that when we got out of the wilderness, I had been up to Turkey Creek in about, I would say, October of last year, and the flood had just scoured, you know, the landscape in terms of there's so much debris that came down the river when that flood happened, rocks and trees and just, you know, all kinds of stuff. And it really cleaned out, you know, the corridor, the river corridor. And so that was really neat to see that. But when we got to Turkey Creek on this backpacking trip, that was all gone because people had started driving all over the place. And so it was really interesting to see it a couple of, you know, 6-7 months from October to June to where it had been reformed into a really natural landscape, to where the flood had just created a completely different ecosystem, if you will. And it was really beautiful to see it like that. But then to see it 7 months later, it was just like heartbreaking in a way to see trails and vehicles driving all over the place and new roads created. And when we got down to the Gila River, you know, we looked a little grizzly because we had been in the woods for a week and hadn't shaved and probably a little dirty looking. And we come across these people with their SUVs, or pickup trucks rather, parked in the middle of the Gila River with their coolers and, you know, lawn chairs and trash just kind of strewn around everywhere. And ironically enough, they actually offered us a couple of Bud Light beers, which we accepted. We didn't want to be rude. But yeah, that was kind of unexpected too. I mean, I had known that people had driven and drove around Turkey Creek, but to the extent that people were doing it was pretty shocking to me, especially after having seen it half a year before, where the flood had made this whole new ecosystem by throwing up debris and sediment everywhere. It looked really natural in October, but then come the summer of this year, it looked a lot different. And that was definitely unexpected to see that, and to be sort of thrown into civilization all of a sudden after you've been in the woods for a week, and to be thrown into that scenario was a little overwhelming. For me, because after I get out of a wilderness trip, I need time to decompress. Once I come back into civilization, into a town, it's too much. It's too overwhelming when you've been alone or just with one person for that period of time, and with nature, when you're walking with mountains and experiencing these wild things, all of a sudden be back in civilization and all these people everywhere, and, you know, traffic and, you know, demands to do things and
kind of culture shock.
It really is. It really is. So that was also, I mean, I guess I've had enough experience that I should have expected that, but that was kind of unexpected too, to be thrown back into people everywhere again, and like trash everywhere, and motorized vehicles running everywhere, and ATVs everywhere. It was like, whoa, it's just too much.
It's
too much.
And vehicles right in the river.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Vehicles right in the river.
You must have passed that vehicle when you were walking down the river, the one that's stuck in the middle of the river, and it's been there so long, there's willows growing out of it.
I didn't see that, to be honest with you.
You didn't see that? I thought that was pretty close to Turkey Creek.
I've heard about this Jeep, famous Jeep. We did not see it. We could have easily walked by it.
Yeah.
It could have easily been washed away. I don't know. I mean, there was 30,000 acre feet of water flowing down the Gila River last September. That is a boatload of water. And there were, you know, we saw canoes that were just wrapped around trees. You know,
yeah.
You'd find debris 20 feet high in a sycamore tree.
Just, right.
So that amount of water, plus all the rocks and literally trees, like, being thrown down the river corridor, who knows? Maybe the Jeep's not there anymore. I don't know. I didn't see it, so I can't testify to it, to be honest.
Did you see junk in the river?
We saw a little bit of, like, physical debris, like of people's homes or like a trailer.
Yeah.
There wasn't a ton, I have to admit, and it wasn't like you would walk and see like a big pile of trash.
Uh-huh.
It'd be more like there'd be a 2x4 over there.
Okay.
And then you'd go a little, you know, another half mile and there's a piece of metal. But again, there was just so much sediment that got washed down the river.
Yeah.
That I would imagine most of that stuff is buried underneath all that sand, gravel, and rock and sticks. But yeah, we didn't see a ton of it. We saw some, but it wasn't like it was, you know, strewn everywhere. It didn't appear to be that way.
Okay, good. That's good to know. So I wanted to ask you about the travel management decision, which came out recently, and in relation to how that's going to impact the area of the Gila River from Turkey Creek down to the Mogollon Box.
Yeah. So the recent travel management decision, the record of decision, and the final environmental impact statement that came out, was that in June? Was that in late June, I believe?
June 11th.
June 11th, middle of June. They selected alternative G, which was their preferred alternative. And in that preferred alternative, in that selection, the area that we just talked about where all the people were driving in the Gila River at Turkey Creek, that is being proposed for closure. There is one segment of it that shows it being designated as administrative access only.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine that is because there is a tiny 40-acre inholding, private inholding, at the confluence of the Gila River and Turkey Creek. It looks like that route goes from the Turkey Creek, you know, quasi campground up to that in holding for the person that owns that private property, is being administrative access only designated. But the rest of those user created routes that were on the maps, were selected for closure, which is a good thing. You know, we shouldn't have people driving all over the Gila River. I can understand that, you know, it's a popular place. People like to go recreate there and that's perfectly fine. But there should be some limitation on what you can and can't do. And I think driving across the river multiple times wherever you please is not a best management practice scenario. So I think that's a good thing. The rest of the corridor from Turkey Creek down to Mogollon Box was already not open to motorized access. So that has stayed the same. That is still not open to motorized access. And that is the area, by the way, that the proposed diversion site would take place is right through the area between Turkey Creek and Mogollon Box. And then they closed off a couple of other little routes down in Mogollon Box area, but then they also designated the campground for dispersed camping and recreation, which people are already doing.
Mm-hmm.
So that seemed to make sense. So, you know, overall travel management, you know, the Grant County Commission recently had what they called a public hearing. You were there, and you know this, that they didn't allow any public comments, so that's kind of a little ironic. You know, having a public hearing with no public comments seems a little backwards to me. And, you know, they kind of, I was not impressed, to be honest with you, at that Grant County Commission meeting. There was quite a bit of public turnout. The Forest Service was there. Kelly Russell, the supervisor, was there. Russell Ward was there. And it seemed like the county commissioners were just really uneducated, to be honest with you. They were asking really basic questions that if you had done your homework, you would know what a maintenance level 1 road is. You would know what a maintenance level 2 road is. And then they started to berate the agency staff, Kelly Russell in particular, that they weren't cooperating with the county government. And it's like, wait a minute, there were like 23 public meetings and there were multiple opportunities. There was like a memorandum of understanding between the U.S. Forest Service and the county.
That's right. They were a cooperating agency.
Yeah. And so to sit there and to say these things, these falsehoods, to be honest, they were just untruth. Was really disappointing. And the fact that the public was not allowed to comment was also super disappointing. And because there was a lot of people there, and mm-hmm. you can testify to the same thing. So many people showed up to that from both sides of the aisle to give their to raise their concerns and to voice their issues, and to be shut out during a public meeting, as it's been deemed, is just it's backwards. And it doesn't make any sense to me that they would do that. So that was deeply disappointing. To be honest, I think the travel management rule, the Forest Service did a decent job. To say that, you know, conservationists or environmentalists would say we should close every single road, that's just as ridiculous as someone saying we should keep every road open. And I think they cut a balance to close roads that were not necessary, where you would have multiple routes going to the same area, essentially, mm-hmm. And to close other roads that were problem roads, like the San Francisco River. Right. Another area, you know, that's a wilderness study area. Shouldn't be driving in there in the first place. But they closed off the section down the San Francisco River. They kept open the section through Big Dry Creek, which, you know, personally I don't agree with. But, again, they had to try and strike a compromise, and I think they did a decent job at that. There's still, what was it, 3,000 miles of roads still open
yes.
in the Gila National Forest? I mean, 3,000 miles of roads
yeah.
are open in the Gila National Forest. That's enough to drive from San Diego to Maine.
It is. I actually did a little bit of math on that, and I figured that if you didn't retrace any of the roads you had already been on and you drove 24 hours a day, you could drive for more than 7 days on all the roads in the Gila. So, I mean, for people to say that isn't enough roads, you got to wonder, well, how much is enough?
Right. I mean, people complain about access. I mean, again, it's just a misconception. It's being misconstrued. It's being falsified. People are spreading rumors and saying things that are just not true.
Yeah.
There is plenty of access still to the National Forest. Many of these places that people care about and that they like to drive to are still available.
Right.
You know, I'd probably say 90% of them, if not more, are the places that people really like to visit and go to and utilize. If you look at the travel management maps and the roads that are closed, you'll find the majority of them are less than a mile that's actually being proposed for closure.
Right.
And you'll still have roads that are, you know, fairly close to that one that's still, they're still open.
Right.
So, you know, again, I think the Forest Service did a decent job. It's not perfect. Nothing ever is in this world. And I think we just have to accept that. And again, I think we need to make sure that the next time our county commission decides to host a public meeting on any issue, really, public comment needs to be had. It needs to be there. You cannot cut out public comment.
Right. Okay, stay with us. We'll be right back after a break. Hi, we're back with Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM, Gila Members Community Radio. I'm Donna Stevens, the director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance and your host for today's show. And with me in the studio is Nathan Newcomer, the Gila grassroots organizer for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. We're talking about a couple of very different trips that Nathan took recently. One of them was into the Gila Wilderness to commemorate the 90th anniversary of the designation of the Gila Wilderness Area, and his other trip was about as different as you could be, as it could be. That's going to Washington, D.C., where the monuments are of a slightly different order there. So,
yes.
But before we get into the D.C. trip, I just wanted to ask Nathan something else about his trip into the Gila Wilderness and some of the work that he did when he was out there was to look at potential new wilderness designation along the Gila River, and this is in the stretch of the river where a Gila River diversion is the site of a Gila River proposed diversion. So I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, Nathan.
Sure. So as we said, as we got out of Turkey Creek, you know, there is the campground there, or quasi-campground that people utilize in Turkey Creek. But from Turkey Creek down through Mogollon Box, it's really wild in there. There's no development of any kind. There's no roads. And it certainly is eligible to be added to the Gila Wilderness. It's immediately adjacent to the Gila Wilderness. It possesses outstanding naturalness. I think the flood absolutely demonstrates that. There were definitely opportunities for solitude and primitive forms of recreation. That was actually a stretch of the trip where we had to climb over a lot of debris, like trees and sticks. Mm-hmm. There wasn't really any natural path through that section. So that was that also sort of elevated its importance and naturalness and primitive forms of recreation. And its size, it's contiguous again to the Gila Wilderness, so it could be added to the Gila Wilderness. I'm pretty sure that's something that we're going to be proposing here pretty soon.
Are those all requirements for wilderness areas,
yeah,
the things you mentioned?
Yeah, you have to. It has to be at least, the first thing is size. It has to be at least 5,000 contiguous acres or of sufficient size that it can be managed for its wilderness characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
That area in particular is about, from Turkey Creek to Mogollon Box, is about 10,000 acres.
Okay.
You would keep Turkey Creek Road open. You would cherry stem it. That's the phrase that we use. What is a cherry stem? The Highway 15 that goes up through Pinos Altos all the way up to the Gila Cliff Dwellings, that is a cherry stem,
mm-hmm.
where you've got essentially wilderness on either side of the road or 250 feet from either side of the road,
right.
Something to that effect. So that's what we would probably likely propose for this particular area, is to cherry stem out Turkey Creek Road so that people can still have access to the area, just not driving all over the place. And then all the way down to essentially the Nature Conservancy property there at Mogollon Box. All of that area is eligible, and it meets the requirements of potential wilderness.
And it's already like that anyway. There's no roads in between Turkey Creek and where Mogollon Creek comes in, so it wouldn't really change people's vehicular access at all.
Right, and it wouldn't change current use at all either. I know that people ride their horses up in that area. Well, if it's wilderness, you can ride your horse in the wilderness area.
Sure.
You can still hike, you can still backpack, wildlife view, nature photography, hunt, fish, canoe, kayak, raft, all those things that people currently do in that stretch of the Gila River would still be allowed.
Yeah. So the only difference really would be that there would be more protection for that area.
Yeah, it would be, it would definitely guarantee that there would be no dam diversion.
Right. No dam diversion. I like that. I wanted to also ask you, I know that while you were out there in the wilderness, you said earlier you had your tablet with you.
Right.
And you were actually doing work while you were out there. And some of the work that you were doing, I believe, was looking at the Gila River to see if it was eligible for wild and scenic river designation. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so in the early 80s, the Forest Service locally had to do a wild and scenic river inventory for not just the Gila River, but for multiple streams and creeks throughout the Gila National Forest. And so they did that. I just recently have been reviewing through legal documents that we FOIA'd from the agency on their wild and scenic river inventory. And it's still a little confusing, to be honest with you. But basically what the agency decided in 1986 was that they were not going to recommend any segments of the Gila River or its tributaries, like the Middle Fork or the West Fork, for wild and scenic recommendation. Their reasoning was pretty lame, to be honest. They said they weren't going to recommend any miles of river for wild and scenic because it was already surrounded by the Gila Wilderness, which is not based in science. It's not based in fact. That's just essentially someone's opinion. For justifying that. So that will, but that's going to change because the Forest Service has a new planning rule that they have to implement. They have to update their 1986 plan from 30 years ago. And since that was 30 years ago, we've had, changed circumstances like climate change, global warming, this diversion issue is a changed circumstance. And so the agency will have to relook at wild and scenic river recommendation. Now, the agency can't designate it wild and scenic, but they can recommend it for wild and scenic, which makes it a little easier for Congress to pass legislation to designate it as wild and scenic. So what I did was I was following the new agency guidelines for how to conduct a wild and scenic river inventory. It's very specific guidelines on how you do that. And so I was using my tablet with a GPS locator in it that could track my movement, and I could take photo waypoints along the way, add my field notes, and demonstrate that, in fact, the Gila River, you know, it really is wild and scenic. And it's a shame it's not been designated wild and scenic in the previous decades before now, but hopefully that'll change.
Okay, yeah, I hope it does change. So it has to be, that's an act of Congress that can pass that sort of designation. But if the Gila National Forest, if the Forest Service recommends it, it's more likely to happen. Is that right?
I wouldn't say it's more likely. It's just that when you look at planning documents in the history of protection of public lands, when you have a document where the agency is on the record as saying, hey, this area is pretty important, or this area is special and possesses outstanding, remarkable values for wilderness characteristics or wild and scenic river designation, when that's on the books, it's easier, I would say, for congressional leaders to take action.
Okay.
It's much harder for a congressional leader to be bold if the agency is not on the record as saying as such. But that being said, even if the agency doesn't recommend it for wild and scenic or doesn't recommend areas for wilderness, you can still have legislation introduced.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of when you look at the history of protection of public lands, it's generally the case when the agency's on the record in a planning document that Congress tends to act.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else you want to tell us about your trip into the wilderness before we get to your other trip?
The moment I got home, I missed it immediately. I wish I was still there. And I hope I get to go back soon.
I'm sure you will. So now let's talk about the very different trip that you took to Washington, D.C.
Oh, yeah.
And I know you weren't just there to look at, you know, the Vietnam Memorial or the Lincoln Memorial or the Smithsonian. So really, what were you doing in Washington, D.C.? What was your objective there?
So about, I would say maybe a couple of days after my backpacking trip in the Gila Wilderness, I get a phone call asking if I would like to participate in the America's Great Outdoors Week in Washington, D.C. And just so our listeners know what that is. The oil and gas industry, the mining industry, logging industry, big guys, they're in D.C. lobbying every week. Conservation groups and nonprofit groups, especially wilderness groups, get to go to D.C. maybe once a year, maybe twice a year if we're lucky, to lobby our delegation and meet with agency employees and just tell them what we're doing and ask for help on certain things. And so this is what America's Great Outdoors Week was. It's basically my chance in 2014 to go to D.C., meet with our representatives and meet with folks at the Forest Service and talk about these issues. So when I got the invitation, I was like, sure, I'll go to D.C. And once I got that notification, I had about 2 weeks to prepare to get to D.C. And I thought, well, if I'm going to go to D.C., I might as well take a bunch of handwritten letters with me from people here in Grant County and Silver who want to speak out and voice their concerns about the diversion and protection of more places in the Gila for wilderness or wild and scenic or anything else. And it was amazing to see the response that we got. We had several volunteers tabling outside the co-op. We had people at, you know, GRIP and UGWA collecting letters, Great Old Broads for Wilderness. A bunch of people got together, wrote letters, hand-delivered them to me, dropped them off to co-op, dropped them off at various places. And by the time I left to Albuquerque to catch my flight, I had over 200 handwritten letters in 2 weeks from people. And that's a really powerful thing.
That is. People don't like to write letters. We should give a shout out here to Brett Myrick.
Agreed.
Who tabled in front of the co-op for days on end. Every time I walked or drove by, there's Brett out there getting people to write letters, which is not an easy thing.
No,
especially handwritten letters.
Yeah, Brett was instrumental. He's my wilderness warrior brother in crime. Much kudos to him and to multiple other people. There were a lot of other folks that really contributed to it. It was a community effort, and it was really empowering to see all those folks take the time to hand write. I mean, literally, we had, not everybody hand wrote a letter, but the majority of them were handwritten.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had typed letters too, but they weren't form letters. These weren't like something that you would, you know, find on an internet site and just click and put your address on it. No, these were people took time. So that was great. And You know, I know, I'm not sure if we need to head to a break or not anytime soon, but just wanted to talk a little bit more about the meetings that we had in D.C. Because, like you said, I did not have any time to go check out the Smithsonian or, you know, Abe Lincoln.
Another trip.
Yeah, you know, that's another time. This is just like meetings, running around catching taxis. And so we had meetings with Senator Martin Heinrich and his staff. We had meetings with Senator Tom Udall and his staff. We also met with Congressman Ben Ray Lujan in the North and Congresswoman Michelle Lujan Grisham, who represents the Albuquerque District. We did not meet with Congressman Steve Pierce, just because in the past, every time we've met with Congressman Steve Pierce, he's been unreceptive and actually hostile towards us.
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, why waste my time? I don't want to get yelled at and mess up all my water crystals inside my body. So we didn't make any attempt to meet with him. But when we got to D.C., I had to make copies of all these handwritten letters, and that took me easily half a day. And by the time we were done, you know, I had over 200-plus letters for the five different meetings that we had, and that's, you know, that's 1,000 letters. So I'm walking around with 1,000 letters the first couple of days looking like some lawyer dude with, you know, reams of paper in his hands and these little legal binders, which is kind of funny. But when we met with the delegation and representatives and their staff, when we gave them those letters, they genuinely looked impressed.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't happen, you know, every day. Somebody walk into your office and say, hey, here's 200-plus letters from Grant County.
Right.
That people hand-wrote. And they really care about the Gila River, and they don't want to see a diversion. They want you to do something about it. And it definitely got their attention. And I have to tell our listeners that after my meetings and coming home, I feel pretty strongly that I don't see how this diversion is going to happen. I really, really don't. It's right now it's at a state level, and the state has to make a decision on what they're going to do, and we'll find out what that's going to be near the end of this year. Supposedly, right? But then it will go to D.C., and the Department of the Interior will play a role, and our delegation can play a role. And they told me that. They said that they will be playing a role, and that once the state makes their decision, that they will be getting engaged. So that was good to hear. It'll be interesting to see what the response is to those letters. Mm-hmm. Because when I talked with Senator Tom Udall, after he left the meeting, he was telling his staff, he said, I'm putting this on your desk. You need to make copies of all this, and you need to read all these and respond to all these.
Wow.
So folks that wrote a letter should be getting a letter back from Senator Udall and Senator Heinrich in response to their issues and concerns. So it'll be interesting to see what they say. I mean, they told me face-to-face that they would be getting engaged. They didn't say exactly what they were going to do, which I didn't expect them to. This is more of just like a, hey, people really care about this and you need to do something. The message was received. And they basically told me to tell folks back home to not panic, to not fear that the worst is right around the corner, that's going to happen tomorrow, that this is going to be a longer process. It's going to take some time.
Well, that's good to know. Let's talk about that some more after our break. Welcome back to Earth Matters on Gila Members Community Radio. This is Donna Stevens, your host for today's show. And joining me in the studio is Nathan Newcomer from the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. We've been talking about the trip that Nathan took to Washington, D.C. when he met with our senators, Senator Tom Udall and Senator Martin Heinrich. I wanted to ask you, Nathan, are there any takeaways that you want to share with our listeners about your experience there in the Capitol?
Yeah, you know, I really did learn a lot going back to D.C. and having conversations. The one meeting that was really impressive to me was the meeting that we had with the Forest Service. You know, typically when you meet with a member of Congress, you get, if you're lucky, you know, 15 minutes of the actual member's time.
Yeah.
And then they give you their staff. You know, they're like, thanks for coming. Nice to see you. We fortunately got to spend quite a bit of time with Senator Martin Heinrich, and Senator Udall, but we got an hour and a half with the Forest Service, which I was really impressed with. I didn't think we were going to get that long time. So it was a really candid conversation, and we met with the Director for Wilderness and Wild and Scenic River Designations at the Forest Service. Liz Close is her name, and she brought in another wilderness specialist guy that's involved with the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act Conference in Albuquerque, Elwood, York. And they were just really warm. They had done their homework because I called them a couple of weeks in advance to say, hey, I'm coming. You know, this is what we want to talk about. Mm-hmm. And so they were well prepared on, they'd read up on the Gila River diversion issue. They had checked out some history on some things. And so they were up to snuff, which was great. I love it when agency people do that and they know what you're talking about when you walk in. And so we talked with them for, like I said, an hour and a half. And we learned a lot of different things about something called the Nationwide River Inventory, which is something that the Park Service did in the early 80s. In 1979, President Jimmy Carter issued a memo that directed agencies to look at rivers throughout the entire country and assess their outstandingly remarkable values. That was the terminology used. And then the Council on Environmental Quality, CEQ, issued directives that talked about if there were going to be any proposed changes to these river segments that possessed outstandingly remarkable values, that they would have to follow a list of protocol and they would have to consult with the National Park Service. Well, as it turns out, 255 miles of the Gila River were assessed in this nationwide river inventory by the Park Service, and 255 miles were found to have possessing outstandingly remarkable values that range from archaeological sites, wildlife resources, river segments that are scenic and wild, cultural resources, all those things. So that was really good to hear. And that they told us that the fact that that is on the books today, that's going to have an impact on any kind of proposed diversion or dam of the Gila River. Since the Gila River already possesses these outstandingly remarkable values, the National Park Service will have to be consulted and engaged in. And that is something that the Interstate Stream Commission, to my knowledge, does not know.
Why did the Park Service do the inventory if it wasn't Park Service land?
Well, it was because of the memo that President Carter issued. He directed the Park Service to conduct the nationwide river inventory.
So outstandingly remarkable, that sounds kind of subjective. Are there certain criteria that make river fit that that phrase?
Yeah, outstandingly remarkable values. What it said was it had to possess at least one outstandingly remarkable value, and the values are certainly spelled out.
Okay.
They are wild, they are scenic, they are recreational, they are wildlife specific, they are cultural specific, archaeological resources specific. So yeah, there's a specific list that they have to follow when they assess that inventory.
And so does a river have to be outstandingly remarkable in order to be designated wild and scenic?
It has to possess at least one outstandingly remarkable value.
Okay.
And of that list that I just went through, it has to possess at least one. And the Gila River was found to possess like five or six of those.
Okay.
So it is. It's been assessed to have outstandingly remarkable values. And it still stands to this day.
And that was in the early 80s, you
1982.
Said?
And then there was a update, I believe, in 91.
Okay.
But I'm not too familiar with the 91 update. I am familiar with the 82 one.
So in the Gila National Forest's plan, which came out in 1986, do they mention wild and scenic designation for the Gila River?
They do. They had to. They had to look at wild and scenic river designation. You know, in our draft, they went through all the different alternatives, and one of the alternatives had recommended segments of the Gila River and other rivers for designation as wild and scenic, but ultimately in the final, they didn't recommend it. And they did mention the Park Service Nationwide River Inventory, but as we said earlier in the program, their reasoning for not recommending segments of the Gila River for wild and scenic is because the Gila Wilderness was already surrounding it.
Yeah.
And that's just... that's not subjective, in my opinion. That's just someone's opinion to say, well, the Gila Wilderness is already there. There's no need for it. Well, if it was designated wild and scenic, we wouldn't be talking about a Gila River diversion right now. It wouldn't be allowed.
Yeah, that would have afforded it additional protection that it doesn't have now, even if it is surrounded by the wilderness area.
Correct.
Yeah. Oh, that's too bad. Do you think that will change at all in the next forest plan, which I know you are heavily involved in?
Well, that's my goal is to push that. Certainly. And I think it will be an opportunity for the public to engage again. The fact that we had people write 200 letters before I went to D.C. is encouraging news. Mm-hmm. That we're going to need people to write letters for this forest plan, too, to make their voices heard and speak out. Because those letters and those comments, they carry weight. And, you know, you don't want to be overly emotional in your comments. You want to be objective, and you want to be able to provide information that's helpful to the agency. I'll be talking a lot more about this in the months and years to come and giving talks on it and presentations, including at the Gila River Festival, that there's a presentation I'll be giving specifically about the forest plan revision, wild and scenic rivers, and wilderness designations in the Gila National Forest and how the public can play a role in that effort. So, yeah, it is going to be an opportunity to push these things. The agency will have to relook at this. Since, again, there are changed circumstances from 30 years ago, and the diversion is certainly one of those issues that would be chalked up as a changed circumstance.
Right. Yeah. Well, you were saying earlier that about climate change. I mean, there isn't one word about climate change in the 1986 plan. I mean, not very many people were talking about climate change back then. Just, you know, a few scientists, some people from NASA maybe, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't something that you heard every day on the street when you just ran into a friend and had a conversation. So that really is a pretty big deal of something that needs to be looked at in the forest plan. It's definitely a changed circumstance. So can you give us a little sneak preview of some of the stuff you'll be talking about at the Gila River Festival about the forest plan and how the public can be involved?
Sure. So the forest planning, let's back up a little bit here just to give some context. In 1982, President Ronald Reagan updated something called the National Forest Management Act. The National Forest Management Act, or NFMA, as we like to call it in our community, is essentially the rule book for how all national forest ranger districts are managed. Is the guidance for a ranger district when they create a management plan. And so 82, that came out. 1986 is when the Forest Service here locally in the Gila updated their land use management plan for the Gila National Forest. Well, the NFMA directives, or the National Forest Management Act, was recently updated by President Obama in 2012 to reflect the changes of 30 years, like climate change and a host of other issues. Bark beetle, forest fires, socioeconomic aspects, looking at how people relate to the national forest and the economy, things like that, were included in the new 2012 National Forest Management Act directives. Now that those have been updated, each ranger district, National Forest Ranger District, throughout the entire country has to update their resource management plan for their national forest. And this will be a process that will take a number of years to complete. But it is an opportunity for the public to participate in crafting that document. And the Forest Service is looking to be really collaborative. That's what they've been doing in other planning areas across the country. And in previous decisions as well, they've been sort of trying to sit people down, get substance out of them, not get into the shouting matches, which we know these things can turn into sometimes, but try to be respectful and provide information that actually will help in terms of managing the national forest, because people that live here know these places like the back of their hand. If they visit them throughout their entire life, they know where great fishing habitat is. They know where beautiful flowers can be found, or where a particular moth or butterfly likes to hang out, or they know where sensitive archaeological sites are, or just other things in general, too, that would be helpful information to provide to the public. Now, specifically, what I'm going to be focusing on, this, you know, the land use plan is a gigantic document. You know, it's like two volumes, 500 pages each volume, really a lot of reading. It's not, you know, it doesn't kind of cheer anybody up. It's not like you're reading fiction or Mark Twain. You know, it's really cumbersome and really difficult reading these things. So I'm trying to drill down into these documents and make it easier for people to understand. And one way I'm going to do that is just by talking about two different issues in the document, and that is wilderness inventories and wild and scenic river inventories. The Forest Service is obligated to conduct these inventories. I am personally, as we've discussed before on previous shows, doing these inventories with volunteers as well. Volunteers such as yourself are also helping out to cover ground because there's so much territory and terrain to look at that it would be completely impossible for me to do it all by myself. So that's what my presentation at the Gila River Festival will entail. It will give a history of what the planning rule is, what people can do, and then specifically, what are wilderness inventories, what are wild and scenic river inventories, and how do you do them? That, in a nutshell, is basically what I will be talking about.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a fun way to get out there in the woods.
Agreed.
As if you need an excuse to get out there. I know it's gotten me out there a couple of times just because I feel like not only am I hiking in a super cool place, but I'm actually helping. I'm actually helping to protect the forest. So that's a pretty good feeling. So if anybody is interested in doing that, Nathan, what can they do? How can they get a hold of you?
They can send me an email. My email address is Nathan, N-A-T-H-A-N, at nmwild.org. Again, that's Nathan at nmwild.org. That's the best way to reach me. Or if you see me around town, just grab me and say, hey, what's up with this wilderness stuff? I want to get outside.
Yeah.
I'll definitely take you on. You know, not everybody needs to be technically savvy with the tablets. Sometimes we get one person in a group who manages all that, and everybody else just kind of tags along and is out there for the day to provide company, which is great too. But you're also, the thing I will say also is that it's, if you have a particular interest, like if you're a botanist or if you love, you know, butterflies or whatever it is, you know, come talk to me about that, because we can always throw people together that have various different interests and expertise that sort of when combined create, you know, a great team.
Right.
And we've got a couple of great teams already put together right now.
Yeah, it's super fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So I think that about concludes our show for today. So thank you, everybody, for joining us on Earth Matters on Gila Members Community Radio. Thank you, Nathan, for letting me interview you this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to our audio extraordinaire, Kyle Johnson. And I hope you join us next week on another edition of Earth Matters.